Welcome to the Breakout CEO Podcast, the show where ambitious founders and scaling CEOs share how they put insight into action and spark pivotal moments, bold moves, and powerful mindset shifts. From building technology and growing teams to navigating pressure and pushing through plateaus, this is where real leaders talk about what it takes to level up in both business growth and leadership skills. I'm Jeff Holman, attorney and founder of Intellectual Strategies. I work behind the scenes with scaling CEOs and get a front row seat to the decisions that drive breakout success. On this show, you'll hear directly from exceptional CEOs about their breakout moments so you can learn how they navigated the risks and opportunities while scaling a business from startup to success. Let's get started. Welcome back, everybody, to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm Jeff Holman, host of the podcast here, and I am super excited to have Steven Selikoff join me today. Steven and I have known each other for a long time. I would give you a long-winded type of introduction to match his expertise from years and years of doing what he does, but I'm going to keep it short and just say something a little more personal. I've worked with Steven with lots of different clients that he's worked with, and he's sent some my way, I've sent some his way. Steven is just a genuinely good dude. Steven knows what he's doing. He helps people through product development. And I'm not talking about he has some ideas or he's read this or that, or he's a guru online that will teach you guru things. Like, Steven is boots on the ground. He'll take you to China, like boots on the ground, meaning he'll take you to China. He'll walk you through the Canton Fair. He'll walk you through manufacturers. He'll show you from A to Z what to do as you're developing products and getting them into Amazon or even into retail eventually. And I really wanted to have Steven on here. I am getting long-winded. I didn't mean to do that. Sorry, Steven, but this is what it is. Like, I really wanted to have him here because I think Steven brings a unique perspective on really hands-on innovation. And CEOs that we work with and the people who are building these companies quickly, going from early stage, zero to one, to raising money or bootstrapping into whatever they're doing, they're innovating. They're creating new products, new platforms, new brands. And I think that the crossover between Steven's experience with innovators and where CEOs in our audience are headed is just a match made in heaven, if you will. So, Steven, so excited to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'll add to that that Jeff didn't mention, he's actually been to China with me.
And that is right. It was a privilege.
A bunch of founders and people who were doing exactly that, starting their companies, moving along their companies, growing their companies. See if I could do this without names, but I know that you were there with us with one person who, when we first met, was doing about 5 to 6 million a year. Now he does about 8 million a month to people who were brand new, starting out, scared, not sure what they want to do, not sure how to do it. And it's just, I'm very incredibly lucky to be able to work with people like this. I love it.
Yep. And that comes through in your passion. And like you said, I've been to China. I've seen you interact with your clients. You're in some of the meetings when they're in meetings with me and my team, because you're literally helping guide them through the process. And so it's a fantastic resource. And we're really lucky to have some of your time, because I know you're always traveling around the world helping people. And so we're catching you in your home, not Shanghai there behind you, but catching you in your home before you head to tell us what you're doing tomorrow and the next day. You're headed somewhere special.
Yeah, heading to Co-Create Conference by Alibaba down in Las Vegas, where I'll be talking about the de minimis rule, the Section 321 rule that's been rescinded for China and other countries. That allows you to import up to $800 worth of goods without duties and tariffs. That rule has now been suspended, and it's causing quite a lot of havoc, and it frankly shouldn't be, which is, I'm going to be quite contrarian when I stand up and talk about it. But if I may, for a quick moment, if you are dependent on not paying duties and taxes to to make your business profitable, then you're not running your business the correct way. Think about the three little pigs. You're building your business out of straw and sticks if you're dependent on that. You need to build your business out of bricks and stone. It needs to be strong enough. Of course, it's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt everyone. But it shouldn't be killing your business because your business needs to be stronger than
that. Makes perfect sense. And for a lot of people in our audience, they're probably at the stage where they have to do other things because they're selling so much product. Well, you mentioned before that one of the people that was there in China with us doing $8 million a month, that's probably difficult for them to rely on de minimis rules in order to build that type of company, right?
You can't rely on that. And I'll give you two other comments which really fit into this. One is the fact that people are CEOs, they know that their business is a business and they talk with you and they learn from you because you are an attorney. There is another very important person on your team, and that is your accountant. I am amazed at how many people doing e-commerce and either don't have an accountant, or if they have an accountant, maybe it's a brother-in-law or something, because they don't know that they can deduct the tariffs and the duties that they're paying. And it just blows me away that people who are very smart, risk takers, who see problems from every angle, have not talked with their accountants about tariffs and duties. That blows me away. And the other thing I was going to say is, this whole thing about tariffs and so on, it's going to happen. 4 years ago, 3 years ago, we had a shipping nightmare where prices went from 4,000 a container to 24,000. And before that, of course, the pandemic. Make your business strong and you'll go through all these and whatever is going to happen next.
Yeah, that's the contrarian view, right? Saying the stuff nobody else will say.
Yeah, I am pretty much contrarian on a lot of things, but it comes from experience. I've probably run into every pothole on the road that you can myself. So it's real life. Things are not as I have a book. We were talking about it just the update just came out. But I have a book that's used in universities, and
you have it there, right? Show us
a
copy of that
someplace.
Book.
Where is it? Here it is. See if it comes up on this screen here. There we go. The complete book of product design, development, manufacturing, and sales, and it's very big. It's a textbook. But when you're in college, when you're taking extra courses, when you're learning things online, lots of times it is aspirational. People are talking about things they would do. The teachers, the people who are teaching you, talking about things they would do or should do and so on. But when you get right down into the trenches, it's a different world. It's a different world. And it's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And I'm excited to hear about some of your wisdom you can share with our breakout CEO audience here shortly. But before that, I really like you mentioned the potholes you've experienced in the past. Give us a flavor for some of your background. What makes Stephen?
Oh, gosh, I have a very weird background. I grew my hair. I had hair for those people looking. I grew my hair long in college. I went off to Europe and I became an entrepreneur in the most personal way you can, which is just based on personal talent and skill. I became an advertising and fashion photographer. And I'm actually going to backtrack a little bit. My first taste of being an entrepreneur was back in 1973. There was a TV show called Star Trek, and the wife of the producer, Gene Roddenberry, his wife, Michelle, would take the film off the editing room floor and just cut it up into little pieces and sell it. And there was the catalog was mimeographed, if anyone remembers what that was. It was mailed out. You could go through, see the different scenes and choose what you want, or buy scripts, phasers, tribbles. I had a tribble. But anyway, I took these little pieces of film and I would blow them up into prints. I went to the Star Trek convention, the first and the second one. At the second one, I actually sold prints from these pieces of film. My brother copied the film or sold this film, so he was making a profit that way. But I realized I could just hold on to the film and just use it to produce product after product. So at 13 years old, I got the entrepreneur bug.
Wow.
And that followed me. As I say, after college, I went off on my own, took a risk, which every entrepreneur knows about. And that was very exciting. Eventually, I got back to the States. I got rid of my long hair. I started putting on a jacket and a tie instead of a black leather everything. And I took on serious roles and worked in serious corporations, including Microsoft. And I was there for 14 years, where eventually I became global business manager of worldwide retail sales and marketing, which was very stressful. I earned my eventual heart attack, but also absolutely amazing. And I had a chance to work with a couple of my bosses, which was like every day was a year of being in business school, meetings with Steve Ballmer and so on. And then I'm supposed to be retired, but I suck at it. So the whole Microsoft, I was also doing my own business on the side. So I never let go of it.
What was the transition point for you? Because Microsoft in charge of retail sales, like that's a big deal. And I get it. The heart attack is probably, I'm just guessing that's probably a motivator there. But outside of the heart attack, like, how did you make that transition? What was doing a side business and just building it up? Or was there a moment in time where you're like, I just love this other side of it? What was that transition?
I'd say twofold. One, no matter how high you go in a corporate ladder, you're still working for someone else. And in my makeup, down to my blood and bones, I want to work for myself. I want my dreams to come true. And you've helping with some of the exciting things we're working on.
Yes.
And then I had my first $1 million seller. And I'm going to be very clear here. I hate when people talk about being a 6 or a 7 or an 8-figure seller and they're talking about revenue and profit are not the same thing. Revenue is what we used to call vanity metrics back when I was in college, and it hasn't changed since then. So don't chase revenue. If you're selling online, don't chase rankings and reviews. Those are all important. And you can look at those as stepping stones or KPIs, but what you're chasing is money. And if you're not making money, then take a step back and say, what am I doing here? Don't substitute other goals. There's only one goal, that's to make money. Anyway, so I had my first big successful product. My wife had got a little dog, not so little, Yorkie that was very big. And the first night with the dog, she got into bed, I got into bed, and then the dog got into bed and just pushed her over. She went right to the middle. I got to the edge. I was about to say something, and I got the look. And if you're married, you know what the look is. So I kept my mouth shut. But I have a tendency to look at life with a sense of humor. And I was at a flower shop, and they had pillowcases. And the pillowcases were for couples that, like, his side, her side, Mr. Right and Mrs. Always Right. Really cute, funny little pillowcases. So I laughed. I said, do you have one, you know, for the dog? And I said, no, but if we did, we'd sell a million of them. That was a light bulb moment. Immediately, he thinks he could sell a million of them. I'm going to figure out how to get this done. So that night I told my wife about it. She laughed. We went to bed. I couldn't sleep. Got up. By the time the sun rose, I already had the entire business structured out. And I made pillowcases. Each pillowcase set split the bed in half. So, for example, one of our very first ones had one half the bed, the dog sleeps here. The other half the bed said, the wife sleeps here. And on the very edge, squished up, said, the husband sleeps here. It was in our own home. And that got into all sorts of big-time retailers, Bed Bath & Beyond, Francesca's, and also Amazon first-person vendor and Amazon third-party marketplace. And it was very different back then than it is now. Amazon's become very complex. It's become very expensive. But it's still, at least for, I expect at least the next 5-6 years at least, the number one place people go to purchase things online. So
what was it? You've seen, and I've seen a lot of people who are at that moment in their lives, right? They're at that. I'm going to call it the pillowcase moment, right? I've been doing my thing, working corporate job or whatever it is, selling this and that. And one day I'm like, why doesn't anybody do this? I need a a product that will solve this problem. Where is it? And then we think to ourselves, why not me? Maybe I'll just create something. And so many people get to that point, right? They get to the point of the pillowcase moment now. You've had the idea, maybe you stayed up all night, you've put stuff on paper, you've said, what if I do this and that? But there's a point between that moment and what you just described. I'm actually selling, I'm actually making, I'm actually profiting off this. Like, for you, what got you, was it easy to get past that moment and jump from the creator to the operator? Or was it a natural step? I'm really curious, because a lot of people get stuck right at that point and they can't push past that. But you clearly did.
Well, it's a very natural step. It's I can't wait to make this happen, to make this real. There's a couple of points when you have products that are just, there's nothing else that comes close to it. The first that you experience is when you have that first product arrive, whether it's in the mail, whether it's local, you're having somebody, created locally, first time you have it in your hands, that's extraordinary. But that is nothing compared to the moment that you're in a store and like some creepy person, you're at the end of the aisle, just hanging out, watching where your stuff is on the shelf. And you see a stranger walk up, see your product, pick it up, look at it, think about it, put it into their shopping basket and pay for it. That is the most extraordinary feeling. And once that happens to you once, you'll never hesitate again. The reason
how did you get there? Because those are two experiences that you had, I'm supposing you hadn't had before. Maybe you did. Maybe because you'd taken those films and blown them up into posters, you'd seen what it's like to sell. Maybe you already knew that.
I know what it's like to sell. I know what it's like to see people excited about buying your product. When they meet you and they find out this is your product, they like talking about it, which is like you're a mini celebrity and all you are is really a business person. But this is very exciting to people. I first started in retailers, if we discount being a 13-year-old selling at a convention. I first started selling at retailers, and I had a friend who was a buyer for a major corporation. I live out here in Seattle. We're near an area called Squim, which is just west of here. And the climate there is very similar to Provence, France. So they have fields and fields of lavender. So I was there with my friend, and she was talking to owners of a couple of the gift stores, and I didn't know about what, but I was going around taking pictures, and then we got back into the car, and she told me that we're going to sell your glass. I said, what? There's lots of glass blowing up here in Seattle, and I've taken some classes. I really enjoyed it. It was a nice way of relaxing, and just like a pianist practicing when they sit down at the piano, typically each time in the hot shop, start off just blowing some little glass balls and just getting myself psyched and ready physically, emotionally. So those little glass balls, she loved them, and you could put color in them. She had made a deal. She became my agent, and not me knowing, and she had made a deal where I was going to provide these gift stores with lavender colored handmade glass balls, artisan made glass balls. And she had done everything. And then she walked me through all of the information I needed to know to start selling to retailers, everything from pricing, keystoning, deliveries, and so on, packaging. This was my entree to all of this. And then 4 years later, I was selling some products on Amazon. And then for everyone who sells Amazon FBA, originally there was no FBA method. It was just Amazon's distribution network, fulfillment by Amazon. So when that started, I was at Microsoft, I had friends at Amazon who said, hey, I know you're always complaining about your warehouse. We're starting this thing, and I signed up. So if someone could get into those identifiers, I'm probably within the first 100 people that ever signed up for, wow, for FBA. But coming back to that, taking that leap, I know what I'm doing. Most people don't take that leap out of two things, both fear of not knowing how to do it, or fear that if we do it, it's going to go wrong. You're never going to fix that second one. There are ways of mitigating all that risk, much as you can. But don't know how to do it? That's easy. Now, mentioned Amazon and mentioned FBA. There's a lot of probably over 1,000 videos on YouTube and courses and everything else teaching people how to sell on Amazon. You're following this FBA method, which is find a successful product, has proven demand, do something, copy it similar to it, and then outmarket them. But there's almost nothing out there talking about the old school way, developing a product that people want and a product that can have a full line. And that's what I help people do. And I do it, I just mentioned there's fear. And as an entrepreneur, you have to have courage. You have to take that leap. But you also want to mitigate that risk as much as possible. So what I did was I've built a product development model called the WTP product development model. Very easy. And WTP is an economic term for willingness to pay. And I think everyone knows the story. How much would you pay for a bottle of water in your home and you have water, but you want a bottle, compared right. to how much would you pay if you're in a desert and you're thirsty and dying and you need a bottle? That's
or WTP. Just at the airport, right?
Oh, yes. When you get through the security and you need something. But I use WTP in a different way. I use it in, if this is a product that existed, solves a problem that you have, dear Mr. Customer, Mrs. Customer, how much would you pay for it? You start off by finding that out from as many people as you can. You get an average of what people expect to pay, what they think the value is in dollar terms of the solution or the desire that you are fulfilling. And you use that as your North Star through the entire process. So when it comes to designing it, you want to make sure you design it in a way that fulfills what people are expecting, but can still be manufactured at one, in our case now, 1/10 of that WTP price. You want to make sure you're profitable from the very beginning. And by using that as a North Star and then dividing it by your multiplier, you use that to guide your design. More importantly, you use that to guide your manufacturing and your raw cost and eventually your landed cost, cost of goods sold. So if you know that everything is geared from the very beginning to result in a price that you, the price to you that you can then sell either directly to consumers or to retailers and still make a profit, a healthy profit, then suddenly you've got a business that you can grow, that you can live on, you can exit. You've got a business that investors like. You've got a business that can change your life. And it's the best job in the world.
I love that. And I've seen you do it many times over. What I love about it really is that you mention that there's really this end result that you're going towards. And for you, profitability in this field, it guides everything. Not just, hey, I have this cool idea. I hope it's profitable someday. And we're going to go through all these steps and then we'll figure out what the profitability is. If we can sell it, profitability is guiding this entire process. Like from what the product is, how it works, how you make it, how you sell it, what channels you go into, everything leads up to, but is founded on profitability. So I love that. And I think having that North Star helps answer the question, like how do people take that leap? If you're just doing it blindly, like you said before, you're full of fear for different reasons, and having that North Star, profitability or whatever it might be, is going to give you guidance and know at least how to orient yourself as you're going through the process. Have I ever talked to you about the four fears of innovators by chance?
No, tell me.
No, I came up with this because I work with so many innovators and I'm like, I don't know, it was like probably 6 or 8 years ago. In fact, you might have even answered a poll on Facebook. That might be about around the time we met. I did a poll on Facebook and I said, with this forum of innovation people or inventor people, and I said, what fears really keep you from taking action with your invention? And I said, I've postulated there are four fears, right? And you mentioned two of them. There's the fear of failure. That's one. People don't want to fail. There's the fear of unknown. I just don't know what I'm doing. There's the fear of loss, which for a lot of inventors translates almost directly into theft. Someone's going to steal this from me. And then there's the fourth one might be counterintuitive, is there's a fear of failure. I said that backwards. There's the fear of success. That's the last one. So failure, unknown, loss, and success. And people are afraid of those. And what you're explaining is, I've always said, hey, action is the solution to fear. Because when you act on something, you bring the futurized fear into the present. You now know what's going to happen. There's no more reason to be afraid of the future because it's the present. You might not like what happened, but at least you know the answer. So you don't, it's not unknown anymore. You already know whether you are going to fail or succeed. And it reminded, your explanation reminded me of that. And I've always been an advocate for the people I'm talking to. How do I get you to act? Now, you've added one more thing in there. Act, I'm going to say act smartly, mitigate your risks. Don't act in a dumb way. I think people get hung up on, is this a dumb thing?
If you're going to take a leap, wear a parachute.
Yeah, exactly. I think I talked about this with another guest just recently who hasn't aired yet, but it'll air soon. And he was like, hey, I got to mitigate my risks. Like I want to succeed, but I do that by identifying it and mitigating the risks along the way, not by just blindly blowing through towards what I think is success.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you were working with us on a really innovative toy. Mm-hmm. And there's only a couple of toys out there that are as innovative as this. And I've hit the market. And I know that when we hit the market, one of our advantages is going to be our price. Because it's very obvious, once you start doing this for a while, it's very obvious to see companies, products, services that are put out there with the idea of, let's get this done, and whatever it costs, we're going to have it done, and then we'll multiply it by a few times and sell it. And that starts you off on financially shaky ground. And again, you've been with me in China. You know that the prices we get are dramatically lower than most people do because they go in expecting that it's going to cost something. And whatever that something is becomes what they pay. And when you go in knowing what you want to be able to pay, now you have a target price and you can make decisions, trade-off decisions, negotiating decisions, materials, and so on, so that you hit that price. But if you don't know where you're going, how do you know if you've arrived? If you don't know what your target price is at the beginning, how do you know that you've got the right price? And lots of times I see this with inventors. I rarely don't see it with inventors. They want to have it done. They put themselves in the hands of people who are saying, we can help you. We can do this for you. We'll teach you how to do this. And I've seen this with Shark Tank clients as well. And then suddenly they've got a product that they're not making money on because it would just be too expensive to actually put out there and sell. You have a great idea. You can make it happen, but you need to think about selling it from the first step.
Yeah. And I've seen those companies too. I've seen companies that have sold tens of millions of dollars in product who can't, they're focused on their ROAS, but their fundamental unit economics aren't good enough and they're still losing money despite all this revenue and the how much they think they're making off of ad spend when they're not.
They
can't survive as a company.
Advertising, all advertising can do is amplify the money you make on one single sale. And you're going to pay money to do that advertising. So there's lots of agencies out there that say, stay with us, come with us, and we're going to make that more efficient. And good ones do. It's not easy. The good ones do that. They make your dollar stretch 10 times more than it was before, but it is still spend. The only place that profit comes into your business is on the profitability of that product. Whether you sell one or you sell 1 million, you've got to have a high enough profit. Otherwise, you're not making money. You're just being more efficient at selling something you're breaking even from. And I have had those conversations with people and it's painful, but it happens.
Oh, it does happen. One of the most basic lessons I remember from part of my MBA schooling was watermelon trucks. Have I told you about that before?
No, I love this.
Guy is selling watermelons, right? He has his truckload of watermelons. He buys it from wherever he buys it. And he goes out and he sells his watermelons. In fact, it's him and his brother, I think it was. I haven't thought about this story for a while. Him and his brother out there selling watermelons out of a truck, right? And they get to the end of the day. They're like, we sold all our watermelons. That's awesome. Count up the money. And they're like, we just lost money. We're not making money on these watermelons. And the brother goes, I got an idea. I know how I can solve this problem. We've only been selling one truck of watermelons. What we need to do is we need to sell two trucks of watermelons and then we'll start to be profitable. The flaw, of course, is if one truck isn't profitable, two trucks of watermelons won't be any more profitable. You're just going to lose twice as much money. And so sometimes we see these, we see people who are, maybe I shouldn't laugh because it's tragic, right? There's a foundational financial issue in the business, and we see people double down on investment. We need more investment, or hey, we need to sell more product, or whatever it is, but they're not actually touching the numbers that change the, like you mentioned, the profitability of the product sold. And so I always think about these two. I see people and I'm like, I think all you're doing is doubling your watermelon sales. You're not actually impacting and probably negatively impacting your profitability of your business.
Yeah, at least those two brothers could count up their money at the end of the day. These days, Amazon does not make it easy for you to understand whether you're making money or not. And that's, I believe there's intent behind it. They don't want people to realize if they think they're not making money. They want people to be excited about their sales. But as I said at the beginning, this is all about making money. Amazon loves to see you spend money. Since COVID, the two fastest growing revenue streams within Amazon are Amazon advertising and for third-party sellers and Amazon fees. It used to always be AWS. So it's crazy that AWS is still bulk of income of revenue, but these are two fastest growing revenue streams. That's insane. So yes, people may not even realize that they are losing money. On the other hand, I did a trade show once and the fellow next to me spent 5 days with his head on a desk crying because he had just landed his first big deal with Bed Bath & Beyond and didn't realize he was losing money in every single sale. It happens out there. Get the accountant, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Get an accountant.
Yes, for sure. So I want to, if you have a few more minutes, I'd love to.
I love talking with you, Jeff.
Oh, I love it too. And time flies very quickly when we're chatting like this. So for the companies out there that have hit their stride, right? You mentioned one person who's doing $8 million a month in sales. For companies that are maybe there or on their way to that point, what is it that they should be thinking about, and how do they, because they're going to hit a couple like probably known obstacles on that path, right? It's kind of like 0 to 1 is one stage, but 1 to 8 million a month, that's another stage. What are a couple of those obstacles that you've seen people hit along the way? And what are the ways that CEOs of those businesses are able to break through those obstacles?
I'm going to split this into two types of companies. One is SaaS companies. You know what your burn rate is. You know what your burn rate should be. And just spending more is not going to get you closer to releasing your product and having it be the success that it should be. So as a CEO, and you know how I hate the term CEO. Sorry for everyone who's listening who's a CEO. I'll explain in a moment why I hate it. But your job is to make sure that you are going to be able to launch, that your burn rate stays where it needs to be, and then you're able to do whatever it is you want to do at launch, whether it's an IPO, an exit, or so on. If you are already in operation stage, a lot of SaaS depends on social media marketing. Luckily, physical products have other methods. You need to be able to watch your budget. That's where a lot of companies lose their money, is on marketing, so people will be aware of their product and then buy it and fall in love with it and everything else. For physical products, it's different. It's also money, but you've got to be able to watch your money, understand how much you're spending, and be prepared for success. Because if you have a product in Target, Walmart's going to want it. If you have a product in CVS, it's going to be picked up by Target. Once you have success one place, other retailers are going to want it. And that means you're going to have to create product inventory. You're going to have to take money out of your pocket and so on. So be prepared for your success. Be prepared for the money challenges. What does that mean? If you're going to be using invoice-based financing and factors, get prepared with that early on. If you are working with manufacturers, work with them from the start so that you've got payment terms. That gives you free money. If you're paying 10% or 15% up front and you're paying the balance 90, 120 days later, you've just gotten a 3-month, 4-month loan free. Make sure that you take advantage of an accountant who understands not just cash flow, but projected cash flow, so you know how much money you will need to be able to afford that success. So I say the biggest challenges in both cases is financial. There's one other challenge, it's not much of a challenge, but I'm seeing it all the time now online, and it makes me laugh. There are people who sell courses on how to sell your service, whatever it is, to high ticket buyers. And their solution is always the same. Make sure that you're offering your services to people who are making $5 million, $10 million, $50 million. So now all over my feeds are all these things saying, are you a CEO making $10 to $50 million? We can help you. This is someone who's never had success in their life, but they're going to help you only because they're qualifying their leads. That's how they've been taught to make a bunch of money. If you're making a bunch of money, as a friend of mine from Shark Tank said, the moment your show airs, you have a $10,000 target on your back. The moment you start publicly saying, hey, we're bringing in this X amount of money, you've got a $10,000 target on your back or more. Just be aware of those.
And that's literal. We see that on the legal side. Somebody thinks you're a successful e-commerce seller, you're going to get trolls go to your website, try to find buttons that don't work and sue you for ADA compliance issues, or sue you for FTC advertising issues, or sue you for FDA food labeling violations. Just because they think you're successful, yeah, maybe they're not coming after you as a client, but they've used the same lead qualification to find you and send you a legal demand letter and looking for that $10,000 to $25,000 payout, or else they'll sue you in court. There's an interesting parallel there that you mentioned between some of the gurus and how they qualify and some of the opportunistic legal entities and how they qualify their targets. So that's really interesting.
When you get to that point, I'm not saying if, I'm saying when you get to that point, you're saying, wow, this is big. It's like the old parable about someone on the back of the dragon. Everyone's impressed, and the person on the back of the dragon says, how did I get up here? It's when you get to that point, believe in yourself. You did what very few people have been able to accomplish. Relax, breathe. You figured it out so far. There are people out there who can help you who are for real. Talk to them. Oh gosh, what is his name? Famous salesman said, it's great to learn from your mistakes. It's better to learn from other people's mistakes, and it's best to learn from other people's successes. So you're there, you're doing it. Ask for help. It's totally a normal, best thing about being human, and believe in yourself, because you can move on. You can make it grow.
Yep. I don't know if that's advice to end on yet, because I have one more question for you, but that's something I talk to a lot of my clients about. I'm like, hey, listen, if we can get you to act like a second time founder instead of a first time founder, you're going to be way better off. And the way to do that is to surround yourself with people who've been there and done that and can help you see around the corners that you haven't been around yet, but they have. I love it. I haven't ridden a dragon yet, so that's going to be something I'm going to add to my bucket list probably. So if you know how to get on that dragon or find those dragons, let me know. But
I'll tell you, I don't know about riding dragons, but I've fought against a lot of windmills. We'll mix our metaphors there.
I'm going to have to ask deeper about that story another day. For the CEOs who are listening out there, you've been around the block a bit. You've helped a ton of people through these paths, navigating with the experiences you've learned, whether it's from some of your own mistakes or other people's successes. What's that parting advice you'd give to people who are maybe struggling to get through a moment in their business? They've hit that plateau. They want to break through the other side. They want to be that breakout CEO, but they can't quite figure it out. What would you advise them to do?
I think we talked already a bit about make yourself available to learning more. Ask, talk to people who've been around the corner, as you said. So I'm going to take a different approach on it. You've got a company, a big company, but you're facing the same fears you did when you first started your company and it was not even existing yet, just an idea in your mind. Don't let fear drive your decisions. Worrying about what can go wrong will never make things go right.
Or worrying about what other people will think if you tell them what went wrong. I think that's got to be mentioned.
This book is huge, and I've filled it with all sorts of mistakes and problems and humiliating events. And people remember them, and they come up and they meet me. And I've met strangers in airports, and they tell me about the failures I've had and how it's helped them. Don't forget that Edison took, 2,447 or something of that attempts at the light bulb before he got it right. Things are screwing up. You still have more than 2,446 tries again. So if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for us.
Very good. I love that. Stephen, it's been a pleasure. As always, we run out of time too quickly on these phone calls, but I'm so glad to reconnect. Good luck with the co-create. I'm going to highlight it one more time because you're going to be out there speaking. They didn't invite you to come just attend the event. They invited you to come and actually speak at the event, because I know you've got those strong ties with Alibaba and with just the presence out there with your book. Again, the book is, share that book with us one more time and let the audience know where they can find you, whether they're looking for product development help or just sage advice.
Well, how can they get a hold of you? The book is on Amazon. My name is pretty unique, Selikoff, and the book is The Complete Book of Product Design, Development, Manufacturing, and Sales. And how to find me, I'm excited to say that we have rebranded ourselves. We had a very long name, just like the book. I guess I have a tendency towards that. And we have just rebranded as Product One, because the product is the biggest priority you have in making money. Make the product profitable, then you'll be profitable. So we're at productone.com, and that just launched. I'm super excited about that.
And it looks great. I popped over there before we got on this call. It's looking great. I love the branding. So congratulations on the relaunch. Thank you again for being on the show, Stephen. It's been such a pleasure having you. And to all of our guests who joined us today, thank you so much. We're glad to have you here at the Breakout CEO Podcast. Leave us a rating. Give us some feedback. Reach out if you know somebody who'd be a great guest like Stephen, or just connect on LinkedIn. We're glad to have you part of our community. Thanks so much, and we'll see you later. This stopped. Thanks for listening to the Breakout CEO Podcast. If today's conversation brought value or sparked ideas, I'd love for you to share this episode with a founder or leader in your network. If you're a scaling CEO with a powerful breakout story or an insight to share, make sure to apply to be a guest on our podcast at go.intellectualstrategies.com. Also, be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.